ports of the Persian Gulf, the source of so much wealth and trouble. Beyond Iran lay the blank southern desert of Afghanistan, and then Kandahar, surrounded by the ruins of its irrigation canals and pomegranate orchards. Now there were only poppy fields, the last resource worth the risk of cultivating in a country so devastated by 20 years of warfare. The savagery of the Soviets was forgotten in the convulsion of the Civil War. Authority had broken down everywhere. The roads were given over to highwaymen who demanded tolls and sometimes abducted children when money was insufficient. Tribes were fighting tribes, warlords against warlords. Drug gangs and the transport mafia dominated the barren economy. The cities had been pounded so hard they were disaggregated into piles of bricks and stones. Electrical posts turned to lace after 2 decades of flying armament and long since stripped of wire, ran along the roadsides as ghostly reminders of a time when Afghanistan had taken its first turn toward modernity. Millions and millions of landmines contaminated the countryside, having disabled 4% of the population, according to a UN survey, and rendering much of the arable land useless. As bin Laden passed over Kabul, the capital was under siege once again, this time by the Taliban. They had arisen in 1994 as a small group of students, most of them orphans, who had been raised in the refugee camps and who were outraged by the chaos and depravity of the rule of the Mujahideen. The liberators in the war against the Soviets had turned out to be more barbaric rulers than their enemy. Stirred to action by the misery that victory had brought to Afghanistan, the Taliban arose with stunning swiftness. Thanks to the support of Pakistani intelligence, they were transformed from a populist militia into a formidable, highly mobile guerrilla army, on the verge of consolidating their rapid rise to power as they stood on the outskirts of Kabul, raining rockets into the ruins. In the next valley, at the base of the Hindu Kush Mountains, was Jalalabad. Bin Laden landed at the same airport that he had laid siege to in 1989. He was greeted by 3 former Mujahideen commanders. Then he moved into an old lodge above the river that had once served as a Soviet military post. A few weeks later, he moved again to a tumble-down farm 5 miles south of Jalalabad. It was owned by one of bin Laden's old sponsors, Yunus Khalis, an elderly warlord with a taste for teenage brides. Afghanistan is a large and rugged country, divided from east to west by the Hindu Kush Mountains, its population split into 4 major ethnic groups and numerous tribes and dialects. It is a difficult country to govern even in peacetime, although peace was such a distant memory that many Afghans had never experienced it. The longing for order was so great that almost any strong, stabilizing power would have been welcomed. The Taliban rapidly captured 9 out of Afghanistan's 30 provinces. President Burhanuddin Rabbani tried to negotiate with them, but they simply demanded his resignation. The wily and experienced commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud, managed to push the young insurgents out of southern Kabul and then roll back their advance in some of the other provinces. After observing the anarchy that came with Mujahideen rule, and deciding that the Taliban offered the best chance to impose order, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan rebuilt the Taliban forces, providing training, weapons, and vehicles, mainly Datsun 4-wheel drive pickup trucks with heavy machine guns, cannons, anti-aircraft guns, or multiple-barreled rocket launchers mounted in the beds. The Taliban moved swiftly in swarms, making up in speed and daring what they lacked in organization and discipline. They hired pilots and commanders from the former communist regime as mercenaries. Opposition leaders acknowledged the flow of events and used the opportunity to stuff their pockets with Taliban bribes. Jalalabad, which had fended off the Mujahideen for months, suddenly surrendered to 4 Talibs in a jeep. The Taliban now commanded the gateway to the Khyber Pass. They also found themselves in charge of a famous refugee. The Taliban had not invited bin Laden to return to Afghanistan and had no obligation to him. They sent a message to the Saudi government asking what they should do with him. They were told to hold on to him and keep him quiet. Thus bin Laden came under the control of a political hermit named Mullah Muhammad Omar, who had only recently declared himself the ruler of all Muslims. Mullah Omar had lost his right eye in an artillery shell explosion in the Battle of Jalalabad in 1989, which also marred his cheek and forehead. Thin but tall and strongly built, he was well known as a crack marksman who had destroyed many Soviet tanks during the Afghan War. Unlike most of the Afghan Mujahideen, he spoke passable Arabic, and he became devoted to the lectures of Sheikh Abdullah Azam. Piety, modesty, and courage were the main features of his personality. He was little noticed in Azam's lectures, except for the occasional shy smile buried within his heavy black beard, and for his knowledge of the Quran and the Hadith. He had studied Islamic jurisprudence in Pakistan. After the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, Omar returned to teach at a madrasa, religious boarding school, in a small village near Kandahar. The fighting, however, did not end, not even when the communist government finally fell to the Mujahideen in April 1992. The violence had no limits. Warring tribes and bandits roamed the countryside. Ancient ethnic hatreds combined with mutual calls for revenge and the escalating savagery. A local commander orchestrated the gang rape of several young boys. Such indecencies were common. Corruption and moral disintegration had gripped the land, Omar later stated. Killing, looting, and violence had become the norm. Nobody had ever imagined that the situation could get this bad. Nobody thought it could be improved, either. In this desperate moment, Omar received a vision. The Prophet appeared to him and instructed this simple village mullah to bring peace to his country. With the fearlessness of total religious commitment, Omar borrowed a motorcycle and began visiting students in other madrasas in the province. The students, the word in Pashto is Taliban, all agreed that something had to be done, but few were willing to leave their studies and join Omar in his risky quest. He eventually gathered 53 of the bravest of them. His old commander in the war against the Soviets, Haji Bashar, humbled by Omar's vision of the Prophet, helped by raising money and arms, and personally donated 2 cars and a truck. Soon, with about 200 adherents, the Taliban took over the administration of the Maiwand district in Kandahar province. The local commander surrendered, along with 2,500 men, a large supply of weapons, some helicopters and armored vehicles, and 6 MiG-21 fighter jets. Desperate for order, many Afghans rallied to the Taliban, who advertised themselves as fervent and incorruptible servants of God. There were 3 streams that fed the Taliban, which flooded across Afghanistan with such extraordinary rapidity. One was the material support, money and arms, from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Some of the Taliban had been students in a vocational school that Ahmed Badib, Prince Turkey's chief of staff, had established during the war. So, from the beginning, there was an intimate connection between Saudi intelligence and the young insurgents. The second stream drew from the madrasas across the Pakistan border, such as the one that Ahmed Badib had established, which were crammed full with the sons of Afghan refugees. Such schools were desperately needed because Pakistan, with one of the highest illiteracy rates in the world, had failed to create a public school system that would adequately instruct its own children, much less those of the 3 million Afghan refugees who had fled to Pakistan after the Soviet invasion. There was an equal number of refugees in Iran. Typically, the madrasas were funded by charities from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries, which channeled the money through local religious parties. As a result, many of the indigenous Sufi shrines were closed down and turned into schools that taught the Wahhabi doctrine. Naturally, the madrasas created a powerful political constituency for the local Wahhabi parties, since they not only provided free room and board, but actually paid a monthly stipend, a vital source of support for many of the students' families. These boys had grown up in an exclusively male world, separated from their families for long periods of time. The traditions and customs and lore of their country were distant to them. They were stigmatized as beggars and sissies, and often preyed upon by men who were isolated from women. Entrenched in their studies, which were rigidly concentrated on the Quran and Sharia and the glorification of jihad, the Talibs imagined a perfect Islamic society, while lawlessness and barbarity ran rampant all around them. They lived in the shadow of their fathers and older brothers who had brought down the mighty superpower, and they were eager to gain glory for themselves. Whenever the Taliban army required reinforcements, the madrasas in Peshawar and the tribal areas simply shut down classes, and the students went to war, praising God as the buses ferried them across the border. 6 months after Kandahar surrendered, there were 12,000 fighters in the Taliban, and twice again that number 6 months later. The third stream was opium. Immediately after capturing Kandahar, the Taliban consolidated control of Helmand province, the center of opium cultivation. Under the Taliban, Afghanistan became the largest poppy grower in the world. The smugglers and drug barons depended on the Taliban to keep the roads clear of bandits. In return, they paid a 10% tax, which became a principal source of income for the Taliban. In Kandahar, there is a shrine that houses what is said to be the cloak of the Prophet Muhammad. The ancient robe is removed from its silver box only during periods of catastrophe. The last time had been during a cholera epidemic 70 years before. On April 4, 1996, Omar took the Prophet's cloak to a mosque in the center of the city. Having announced on the radio that he would display the relic in public, he climbed on the roof of the mosque and for 30 minutes paraded around with his hands in the sleeves of the cloak, while a delirious crowd cheered his designation as Amir al-Mu'mineen, the leader of the faithful. Some people in the crowd fainted, others threw their hats and turbans into the air, hoping that they would brush against the sacred garment. Of course, it was the dream of Islamists everywhere that their religion would again be unified under the rule of a single righteous individual. Kings and sultans had bid for the role, but none had wrapped himself in the mantle of the Prophet, as had this obscure mullah. It was a gesture both preposterous and electrifying. Omar gained the political authority he needed to pursue the war, but more than that, the action symbolically promised that the Taliban, as a moral force, would roll through Afghanistan and then magnify itself throughout the Islamic world. Bin Laden's families and some of his followers arrived in Jalalabad to find rudimentary quarters, tents for the wives with latrines and drainage ditches set inside a barbed wire enclosure. When winter arrived, Bin Laden secured new housing for the families on a former Soviet collective farm, which he called Najm al-Jihad, Star of the Holy War. The men bunked nearby, in the old ammunition storage cavern that Bin Laden had excavated in Tora Bora. He outfitted the main cave with an armory of Kalashnikovs, a theological library, an archive of press clippings, and a couple of mattresses draped across several crates of hand grenades. He went back into business, setting up a modest trade in honey. But Afghanistan has almost no commercial infrastructure, so there was little he could actually do. The three wives who stayed with him were accustomed to hardship, which Bin Laden naturally embraced. He no longer slaughtered a lamb every day to serve his guests. Now he rarely ate meat, preferring to live on dates, milk, yogurt, and flatbread. Electricity was available for only 3 hours a day, and because there was no international telephone service, his wives were completely cut off from their families in Syria and Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden had a satellite phone, but he spoke on it sparingly, believing that the Americans were monitoring his calls. He was suspicious of mechanical devices in general, even clocks, which he thought might be used for surveillance. Mainly, however, he was worried about the Taliban. He had no idea who they were. The anxious tribesmen in the northern region of Afghanistan spread rumors that the Taliban were a huge army of communists. When two of his Mujahideen sponsors, Governor Mahmoud and Maulvi Saznur, were killed in an ambush soon after Jalalabad fell, bin Laden taught his wives how to shoot. The Taliban knew something about bin Laden, though, and they were just as worried about him as he was about them. "We don't want subversive actions to be launched from here against any other countries," the Taliban's acting information minister declared. "In areas under Taliban control, there are no terrorists." But they had heard about the millions he had poured into Sudan, and they assumed he was still a wealthy Islamic philanthropist. They hoped to use his money and expertise to rebuild their shattered country. Mullah Omar was also mindful of the pledge he had given, no doubt supported by many millions of Saudi rials, to keep his guests silent and out of trouble. After Jalalabad fell, the Taliban finally entered Kabul. The victorious young fighters broke into the UN compound, where Najibullah, the former president of Afghanistan from his communist era, had taken refuge since the fall of his government 4 years before. He and his brother were beaten and tortured, castrated, dragged behind a jeep, shot, then hanged from a traffic pole in downtown Kabul. Cigarettes were placed in their mouths and money was stuffed in their pockets. There was little to mourn about a man who had begun his career as a torturer in the secret police, but the immediate disregard for international protocols, the casual savagery, the mutilation of the body, forbidden in Islam, and the absence of any court of justice set the stage for the carnival of religious tyranny that characterized the Taliban era. The Saudis and the Pakistanis, the Taliban's chief backers, quickly recognized the new government. During the entire Taliban reign, only one other country, the United Arab Emirates, recognized their rule as legitimate. "Women, you should not step outside your residence," the new government ordered. Women were a particular target, as might be expected from men who had so little experience of their company. "If women are going outside with fashionable, ornamental, tight and charming clothes to show themselves," the decree continued, "they will be cursed by the Islamic Sharia and should never expect to go to heaven." Work and schooling for women were halted at once, which destroyed the healthcare system, the civil service, and effectively eliminated elementary education. 40% of the doctors, half of the government workers, and 7 out of 10 teachers were women. Under the Taliban, many of them would become beggars. The Taliban also turned their attention to ordinary pleasure. They forbade kite flying and dog raising. Trained pigeons were slaughtered. According to the Taliban penal code, unclean things were banned, an all-purpose category that included pork, pig, pig oil, anything made from human hair, satellite dishes, cinematography, any equipment that produces the joy of music, pool tables, chess, masks, alcohol, tapes, computers, VCRs, televisions, anything that propagates sex and is full of music, wine, lobster, nail polish, firecrackers, statues, sewing catalogs, pictures, Christmas cards. The fashion dictators demanded that a man's beard be longer than the grip of his hand. Violators went to jail until they were sufficiently bushy. A man with beetle-y hair would have his head shaved. Should a woman leave her home without her veil? "Her home will be marked and her husband punished," the Taliban penal code decreed. The animals in the zoo, those that had not been stolen in previous administrations, were slain or left to starve. One zealous, perhaps mad Taliban jumped into a bear's cage and cut off his nose, reputedly because the animal's beard was not long enough. Another fighter, intoxicated by events of his own power, leaped into the lion's den and cried out, "I am the lion now." The lion killed him. Another Taliban soldier threw a grenade into the den, blinding the animal. These two, the noseless bear and the blind lion, together with two wolves, were the only animals that survived the Taliban rule. "Throw reason to the dogs," read a sign posted on the wall of the office of the religious police, who were trained by the Saudis. "It stinks of corruption." And yet the Afghan people, so exhausted by war, initially embraced the imposition of this costly order. While bin Laden was setting up in Jalalabad, his friend and military chief, Abu Ubaida, was in East Africa, overseeing the Al-Qaeda cell that had been established 2 years before. The former Egyptian policeman was a revered figure in Al-Qaeda. His courage was legendary. He had been with bin Laden during the war against the Soviets, all the way from the Battle of the Lion's Den to the siege of Jalalabad. Some said that if Zawahiri had taken over bin Laden's brain, Abu Ubaida had his heart. He was bin Laden's most trusted emissary, often serving as a mediator between Al-Qaeda and Al-Jihad. He trained Mujahideen in Bosnia, Chechnya, Kashmir, and Tajikistan, drawing valuable recruits to the Qaeda camps. In Kenya, he had taken a new identity and married a local woman, claiming to be in the mining business, while he was actually preparing Al-Qaeda's first great strike against America. On May 21st, 3 days after bin Laden left Sudan for Afghanistan, Abu Ubaida and his Kenyan brother-in-law, Ashif Mohammed Juma, were in a second-class cabin in an overloaded ferry on Lake Victoria, traveling to Tanzania. One of the ballast tanks was empty, and in the early morning the ferry capsized in rough water. Juma managed to get through the door of the cabin into the corridor, but the five other passengers crammed into the tiny compartment were trapped. The door was now above them, and water was gushing in from an open portal. Passengers were screaming, luggage and mattresses were falling on top of them, and they clawed at each other in order to reach the door, their only escape. Juma grabbed Abu Ubaida's hand and pulled him halfway out of the room, but suddenly the door was ripped from its hinges, and Al-Qaeda's military chief was pulled back into the cabin by his doomed companions. This was the nadir of bin Laden's career. Abu Ubaida was not his only loss. Others, such as Abu Hajar, chose not to follow bin Laden back to Afghanistan. The Saudi was isolated, stripped of his once great wealth, dependent on the hospitality of an unknown power, and yet he was not broken or even subdued. His life was lived in two spheres, the existential and the sacred. His flight to Jalalabad and the scandal of his current circumstances must have struck him, on one level, as a nearly hopeless exile. But in spiritual terms, it recapitulated a critical moment in the Prophet's life when, in 622, ostracized and ridiculed, he was expelled from Mecca and fled to Medina. The Hijra, or retreat, as the event is called, was such a significant turning point that it begins the Islamic calendar. The Hijra transformed Muhammad and his demoralized followers. Within a few years, their nascent religion burst out of Medina and spread from Spain to China in a blinding flash of conversion and conquest. Since childhood, bin Laden had consciously modeled himself on certain features of the Prophet's life, choosing to fast on the days the Prophet fasted, to wear clothes similar to those the Prophet may have worn, even to sit and to eat in the same postures that tradition ascribes to him. And although none of this is unusual for a strict Muslim, bin Laden instinctively referenced the Prophet and his era as the template of his own life and times. Intervening history meant little to him. Naturally, he would turn to the Prophet's example for consolation during his own period of defeat and withdrawal. However, he was also savvy enough to recognize the symbolic power of his own hijra and its usefulness as a way of inspiring his followers and beckoning to other Muslims to join his sacred retreat. He brilliantly reframed the disaster that had fallen upon him and his movement by calling up images that were deeply meaningful to many Muslims and practically invisible to those who were unfamiliar with the faith. Afghanistan was already marked by miracles, the deaths of martyrs, and the defeat of the superpower. Bin Laden now called this country Khorasan, referring to the ancient Muslim empire that once encompassed much of Central Asia. His followers adopted names that harked back to the companions of the Prophet or to famous warriors of early Islam. There is a disputed hadith that states that, in the last days, the armies of Islam will unfold black banners, like the flag of the Taliban, and come out of Khorasan. Their names will be aliases, and they will carry the names of their cities in the same manner that Al-Qaeda's legion followed. All of these references were in the service of connecting with a former greatness and reminding Muslims of their devastating loss. The key symbol of bin Laden's hijra, however, was the cave. The Prophet first encountered the angel Gabriel, who revealed to him, "You are the messenger of God," in a cave in Mecca. Again, in Medina, when Muhammad's enemies pursued him, he hid in a cave that was magically concealed by a spider web. Islamic art is replete with images of stalactites, which reference both the sanctuary and the encounter with the divine that caves provided the Prophet. For bin Laden, the cave was the last pure place. Only by retreating from society and from time, history, modernity, corruption, the smothering West, could he presume to speak for the true religion. It was a product of bin Laden's public relations genius that he chose to exploit the presence of the ammunition caves of Tora Bora as a way of identifying himself with the Prophet in the minds of many Muslims who longed to purify Islamic society and restore the dominion it once enjoyed. On the existential plane, bin Laden was marginalized out of play, but inside the chrysalis of myth that he had spun about himself, he was becoming a representative of all persecuted and humiliated Muslims. His life and the symbols in which he cloaked himself powerfully embodied the pervasive sense of dispossession that characterized the modern Muslim world. In his own miserable exile, he absorbed the misery of his fellow believers. His loss entitled him to speak for theirs. His vengeance would sanctify their suffering. The remedy he proposed was to declare war on the United States. You are not unaware of the injustice, repression, and aggression that have befallen Muslims through the alliance of Jews, Christians, and their agents, so much so that Muslims' blood has become the cheapest blood, and their money and wealth are plundered by the enemies, bin Laden said on August 23, 1996. In his declaration of war against the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places. The latest indignity, one of the worst catastrophes to befall the Muslims since the death of the Prophet, was the presence of American and coalition troops in Saudi Arabia. The purpose of his treatise was to talk, work, and discuss ways of rectifying what has befallen the Islamic world in general and the land of the two holy mosques in particular. "Everyone is complaining about everything," bin Laden observed, adopting the voice of the Islamic man on the street. "People have been greatly preoccupied with matters of their livelihood. Talk of economic decline, high prices, massive debts, and overcrowded prisons is widespread. As for Saudi Arabia, everyone agrees that the country is moving toward a deep abyss." Those brave few Saudis who confronted the regime demanding change were disregarded. Meanwhile, the war debt had caused the state to impose taxes. "People are wondering, is ours really the largest oil-exporting country? They feel that God is tormenting them because they kept quiet about the regime's injustice." He then taunted the American Secretary of Defense, William Perry, by name. "Oh, William, tomorrow you will know which young man is confronting your misguided brethren. Terrorizing you while you carry weapons in our land is a legitimate and moral obligation." He was so far from being able to carry out such threats that one might conclude that the author of this document was utterly mad. Indeed, the man in the cave had entered a separate reality, one that was deeply connected to the mythic cords of Muslim identity, and in fact gestured to anyone whose culture was threatened by modernity and impurity and the loss of tradition. By declaring war on the United States from a cave in Afghanistan, bin Laden assumed the role of an uncorrupted, indomitable primitive, standing against the awesome power of the secular, scientific, technological Goliath. He was fighting modernity itself. It did not matter that bin Laden, the construction magnate, had built the cave using heavy machinery and that he had proceeded to outfit it with computers and advanced communications devices. The stance of the primitive was appealingly potent, especially to people who had been let down by modernity. However, the mind that understood such symbolism and how it could be manipulated was sophisticated and modern in the extreme. Soon after bin Laden set up his camp in Tora Bora, he agreed to meet a visitor named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He had known Mohammed slightly during the anti-Soviet jihad, when Mohammed worked as a secretary for bin Laden's old sponsor, Sayyaf, and also for Abdullah Azzam. Far more significantly, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was also the uncle of Ramzi Youssef, who had bombed the World Trade Center in 1993. Now Youssef was under arrest and his uncle was on the run. Except for their hatred of America, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Osama bin Laden had almost nothing in common. Mohammed was short and squat, pious but poorly trained in religion, an actor and a cut-up, a drinker and a womanizer. Whereas bin Laden was provincial and hated travel, especially in the West, Mohammed was a globetrotter fluent in several languages, including English, which he perfected while studying mechanical engineering at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, a mostly black school in Greensboro. In Tora Bora, Mohammed briefed bin Laden about his life since the anti-Soviet jihad. Inspired by Ramzi Youssef's attack on the World Trade Center, Mohammed joined his nephew for a month in the Philippines in 1994. They came up with an extraordinary plan to bomb 12 American jumbo jets over the Pacific. They called it Operation Bojinka, a nonsense word that Mohammed had picked up when fighting in Afghanistan. Ramzi Youssef, the master bomb maker, had perfected a small nitroglycerin device that was undetectable by airport security. He tested it out on a flight from Manila to Tokyo. Youssef got off the flight in Cebu, a city on one of the central islands of the Philippine archipelago. The passenger who took his seat was Haruki Ikegami, a 24-year-old Japanese engineer. 2 hours later, the bomb under Ikigami's seat detonated, tearing him apart and nearly bringing the aircraft down. The assault that Youssef and Mohammed were planning would bring international air travel to a complete standstill. Although bin Laden claims he did not know Youssef personally, he had sent a messenger to Manila to ask Youssef to do him the favor of assassinating President Bill Clinton when he came to Manila in November 1994. Youssef and the others mapped out the president's route and sent to bin Laden diagrams and sketches of possible points of attack. Finally, however, Youssef decided that the security was too tight. The men thought instead to kill Pope John Paul II when he came to the city the following month, even going so far as to get priests' cassocks. But that plan, too, came to nothing. The Manila police caught on to them after chemicals in their apartment caught fire, and Youssef fled, leaving behind his computer, with all their plans encrypted on the hard drive. The plans were still in Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's mind, however. He came to bin Laden with a portfolio of schemes for future attacks against America, including one that would require training pilots to crash airplanes into buildings. Bin Laden was noncommittal, although he did formally ask Mohammed to join al-Qaeda and move his family to Afghanistan. Mohammed politely declined, but the seed of September 11 had been planted. Chapter 14. Going Operational. On June 25, 1996, John O'Neill arranged a private retreat for FBI and CIA agents at the Bureau's training center in Quantico, Virginia. There were hamburgers and hot dogs, and O'Neill even let the CIA officers on the firing range, since they rarely had the opportunity to shoot. It was a lovely day. O'Neill went out to play a round of golf on the Quantico course. Suddenly, everyone's beepers went off. There had been a catastrophic explosion in Saudi Arabia at the Khobar Towers military housing complex in Dhahran. The building served as the barracks for the 4,404th Airlift Wing, which was enforcing the no-fly zone in Iraq. 19 American soldiers had died, and nearly 400 other people were injured. O'Neill assembled a team of more than 100 agents, support personnel, and members of various police agencies. The next day, they were on an Air Force transport plane to Saudi Arabia. A few weeks later, O'Neill himself joined them, along with the director of the FBI, Louis Free. A slender and sober man, Free was temperamentally O'Neill's opposite in many ways. The director prided himself on being a family man, usually leaving the office at 6 in order to be home with his wife and children. Unlike O'Neill, who was fascinated by gadgetry and always had the latest electronic organizer or mobile phone in his pocket, Free was bored by technology. One of his first actions on taking office in 1993 was to jettison the computer on his desk. The Bureau was technologically crippled even before Free arrived, but by the time he left, not even church groups would accept the vintage FBI computers as donations. Like most of his male agents, Free inclined toward cheap suits and scuffed shoes, posing quite a contrast to O'Neill, his subordinate, in his Burberry pinstripes and his Bruno Magli loafers. It was evening when the two men, along with a small executive team, arrived in Dhahran. The disaster site was a vast crater, 85 feet wide and 35 feet deep, illuminated by lights on high stanchions. Nearby lay charred automobiles and upended Humvees. Looming above the debris were the ruins of the housing complex. The bomb was larger by far than the car bomb that had destroyed the Saudi National Guard training center the year before, and even more powerful than the explosives that had killed 168 people in Oklahoma City in 1995. O'Neill walked through the rubble, embracing exhausted agents who were sifting sand for evidence and painstakingly bagging personal effects. Body parts still lay in the sand, indicated by circles of red paint. Under a tarp nearby, investigators were gradually reconstructing fragments of the truck that had carried the bomb. The agents on the ground were demoralized by the obstacles that Saudi investigators put in their path. They were not allowed to interview witnesses or question suspects. They couldn't even leave the bomb site. In the opinion of the agents, the Saudis were obstructing the investigation because they didn't want to expose the existence of internal opposition in the kingdom. The impression, quickly formed by agents with little experience in the Middle East, was that the Saudi royal family was hanging on to power by their fingernails. Free was initially optimistic that the Saudis would cooperate, but O'Neill became more and more frustrated as the late-night meetings drifted on a sea of pleasantries. As they were flying home after one of their several trips to the kingdom together, Free was upbeat. "Wasn't that a great trip? I think they're really going to help us." O'Neill replied, "You've got to be kidding. They didn't give us anything. They were just shining sunshine up your ass." For the remainder of the flight, Free refused to speak to him. But recognizing O'Neill's passion and talents, he sent him back to Saudi Arabia to continue lobbying for cooperation. O'Neill met with Prince Naif and other officials. They listened grudgingly to his pleas. Intelligence agencies across the world are jealous and insular organizations, not inclined to share information, which O'Neill appreciated. He was used to cadging what he could through charm and persistence, but the Saudis were seemingly immune to his wooing. They were far more closed-mouthed than any other police organization he had ever worked with. The Americans were infuriated to learn that a few months earlier, Saudi authorities had intercepted a car from Lebanon that was stuffed with explosives and headed for Khobar. It was Naif who decided not to inform his U.S. counterparts. In addition to their ingrained cultural reticence, the Saudis had legal reasons to be cautious in dealing with the Americans. Because the kingdom is governed by Sharia law, clerical judges have complete discretion to throw out any evidence they don't care to hear, such as material provided by foreign agencies. The Saudis were worried that the involvement of the FBI would taint the case. O'Neill worked out an agreement that allowed the FBI agents to interview suspects through mirrored glass, which gave the Bureau access while preserving the appearance of separation that the Saudis insisted upon. As the evidence began to point to Iranian-backed terrorists as being the most likely perpetrators of the bombing, however, the Saudis became reluctant to pursue the investigation. They worried what the Americans would do if Iran were implicated, which soon became the case. The Saudis' own investigation pointed to a branch of Hezbollah inside the kingdom. Economic and diplomatic sanctions against Iran appeared unlikely because the Europeans wouldn't go along. "Maybe you have no options," one of the Saudis told O'Neill. "If it is a military response, what are you going to bomb? Are you going to nuke them, flatten their military facilities, destroy their oil refineries? And to achieve what? We are next door to them. You are 6,000 miles away." In the new era of a globalized FBI, O'Neill learned, it was one thing to solve the case, another to gain justice. O'Neill longed to get out of Washington and go operational. He wanted to supervise cases again. In January 1997, he became special agent in charge of the National Security Division in New York, the Bureau's largest and most prestigious field office. When he arrived, he dumped four boxes of Rolodex cards on the desk of his new secretary, Lorraine DiTaranto. Then he handed her a list of everyone he wanted to meet: the mayor, the police commissioner, the deputy police commissioners, the heads of the federal agencies, and religious and ethnic leaders in all five boroughs. Within 6 months, he had checked off all the people on his list. By then, it seemed as if he had lived in New York his entire life. The city was a great stage upon which O'Neill claimed a title role. He stood with John Cardinal O'Connor, the Archbishop of New York, on the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral during the St. Patrick's Day parade. He prayed with imams in Brooklyn. Sports figures and movie stars such as Robert De Niro consulted him and called him their friend. "John, you've got this town wired," one of his buddies said after a late night when it seemed that everyone had bowed in O'Neill's direction. O'Neill replied, "What's the point of being sheriff if you can't act like one?" O'Neill was now in charge of counterterrorism and counterintelligence in a city that was full of emigres, spies, and shady diplomats. The particular squad responsible for the Middle East was called, in the noncommittal bureaucratic vernacular, I-49. Its personnel spent the bulk of their time covering the Sudanese, Egyptians, and Israelis, all of whom were actively recruiting in New York. Most members of the squad were native New Yorkers who had stayed close to home. They included Louis Napoli, an NYPD detective, who had been assigned to I-49 through the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Napoli still lived in the same house in Brooklyn that he had grown up in. The Antisef brothers, John and Mike, also from Brooklyn, were the children of Croatian immigrants. Richard Karnowitz was a Brooklyn son of Polish immigrants who played polkas on his accordion. Jack Clunan grew up in Waltham, Massachusetts, and it was not only his accent that set him apart. He was an English and Latin major who joined the Bureau in 1972, on the day its director, J. Edgar Hoover, died. Carl Summerlin was a black New York State trooper and former tennis champion. Kevin Cruz was a West Point graduate and former captain in the 82nd Airborne. Mary Deborah Doran was the daughter of an FBI agent. She had worked for the Council on Foreign Relations before going to Northern Ireland for graduate work in Irish history. Their supervisor was Tom Lang, a blunt, profane, and quick-tempered Irishman from Queens who had known O'Neill from the days when they both served as tour guides at headquarters. Some members of the squad, like Lang and the Antisef brothers, had been working on terrorism for years. Others, like Debbie Duran, were new to the squad. She had joined the Bureau in 1996 and was assigned to New York the month before O'Neill took over. This squad would soon grow much larger, but the nucleus was these seven agents, one state trooper and a city police detective. The other member of the squad was Dan Coleman, who was assigned to Alex Station and who had been laboring alone on the Bin Laden case. When O'Neill arrived, however, most of the I-49 squad had been diverted to work on the crash of TWA Flight 800, which occurred off the coast of Long Island in July 1996. Dozens of witnesses reported having seen an ascending flare that culminated in a mid-air explosion. It appeared to have been one of the worst acts of terror in American history, and the Bureau mobilized all its impressive resources to solve the crime as quickly as possible. The Khobar Towers bombing and TWA 800 investigations were absorbing all the Bureau's available manpower without any resolution in sight. At the outset, investigators believed that the plane had been bombed or shot down in retaliation by followers of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who was on trial in New York at the time. But after 3 months, they came to the conclusion that the aircraft had suffered a freakish mechanical failure. The case had become largely a public relations problem. In the face of vivid eyewitness testimony, the Bureau simply didn't know how to explain its conclusions to a skeptical public. Demoralized agents continued to comb through the wreckage of the plane, which was being put back together piece by piece in a hangar on Long Island. O'Neill needed his squad back. Together with the Defense Department, O'Neill determined the height of TWA 800 and its distance from shore at the time of the explosion. He demonstrated that it was out of range of a Stinger missile, the most likely explanation at the time of the apparent vapor trail that witnesses noted. O'Neill proposed that the flare could have been caused by the ignition of leaking fuel from the aircraft, and he persuaded the CIA to do a video simulation of this scenario, which proved to be strikingly similar to the witnesses' accounts. Now he could get to work on bin Laden. Alex Station was named after the adopted Korean son of O'Neill's temperamental CIA counterpart, Michael Scheuer. For the first time, the Bureau and the agency were working in tandem on a single project, an unprecedented but awkward partnership. As far as Scheuer was concerned, the FBI simply wanted to place a spy inside Alex Station in order to steal as much information as possible. Yet Scheuer grudgingly came to respect Dan Coleman, the first Bureau man to be posted inside his domain. Coleman was overweight and disheveled, with a brushy mustache and hair that refused to stay combed. He was as cantankerous as a porcupine. His FBI colleagues called him Grumpy Santa behind his back, but he had none of the macho FBI swagger that Scheuer so despised. It would have been easy to dismiss Coleman as another nebbishy bureaucrat, except for his intelligence and decency, the very qualities Scheuer most admired. But there was a fundamental institutional conflict that friendship could not bridge. Coleman's mission as an FBI agent was to gather evidence with the eventual goal of convicting bin Laden of a crime. Scheuer, the CIA officer, had determined early on that the best strategy for dealing with bin Laden was simply to kill him. Although Coleman dutifully reported to his superiors at the FBI, the only person genuinely interested in what he was learning was O'Neill, whom he first met at one of Dick Clark's briefings in the White House. O'Neill was fascinated by the Saudi dissident at a time when it was rare to meet anyone, even in the Bureau, who knew who Osama bin Laden was. Then, a couple of months before O'Neill arrived in New York, Coleman had interrogated Jamal al-Fadl, the al-Qaeda defector, who revealed the existence of the terror organization and its global ambitions. In the several weeks he had spent with Fadl in a safe house in Germany, learning about the structure of the group and the personalities of its leaders, Coleman had come to the conclusion that America faced a profound new threat. And yet his reports met with little response outside a small circle of prosecutors and a few people in the agency and the Bureau who took an interest, mainly Scheuer and O'Neill. They were the two men most responsible for putting a stop to bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and yet they disliked each other intensely, an emotion that reflected the ingrained antagonism of the organizations they represented. From the start, the response of American intelligence to the challenge presented by al-Qaeda was hampered by the dismal personal relationships and institutional warfare that these men exemplified. Coleman was caught between these two bull-headed, tempestuous, talented individuals who constantly battled each other over a subject, bin Laden, that neither of their organizations really cared about. In his cubicle in Alex Station, Dan Coleman continued to pursue leads that had been turned up from the Fadl interviews. He examined telephone transcripts from the wiretap phones that were tied to bin Laden's businesses in Khartoum. One frequently called number belonged to bin Laden's former secretary, Wadi al-Hajj, in Nairobi, Kenya. Most of Hajj's conversations had been translated from Arabic, but others were in English, especially when he was talking to his American wife. He often made awkward attempts at speaking in code, which his wife obstinately refused to understand. "Send 10 green papers, okay?" Hajj said in one exchange. 10 red papers?" she asked. "Green." "You mean money," she concluded. "Thank you very much," he responded sarcastically. Coleman took an interest in Hajj, who seemed, despite his clumsy tradecraft, to be an attentive father and a caring husband. Whenever he was away, he would call his children and caution his wife about letting them watch too much television. He was ostensibly running a charity called Help Africa People, while making a living as a gym dealer. The CIA thought Hajj might be recruited as an agent. As Coleman studied the transcripts, he decided Hajj was unlikely to turn, but he agreed to go to Kenya, thinking that at least he might find some evidence to substantiate the existence of this organization, Al-Qaeda, that Fadl had described. In August 1997, Coleman and two CIA officers appeared at Hajj's home in Nairobi with a search warrant and a nervous Kenyan police officer carrying an AK-47. The house sat behind a high cinder block wall covered with broken glass, guarded by a scrawny German shepherd on a rope. Hajj's American wife, April Bright Sky Ray, and her six children were there, along with April's mother, Marion Brown. Both women, Islamic converts, were wearing hijabs. It was odd to see them in person after having studied them from such a distance. Coleman put the women in the same category as mob wives, knowledgeable in some general way that unlawful actions were going on, but not legally complicit. April was a heavy woman with a pleasant round face. She said her husband was out of the country on business. Actually, he was in Afghanistan talking to bin Laden. But he would be back that evening. Coleman showed her his warrant to search for what he said were stolen documents. The place was filthy and swarming with flies. One of the children had a high fever. While the agency people talked to April in another room, Marion Brown closely watched Coleman going through their drawers and closets. "Would you like some coffee?" Brown asked. Coleman took a look at the kitchen and declined. "That's good, because I might be trying to poison you," she said. There were papers and notebooks stacked everywhere, gas receipts that were 8 years old, and business cards for bankers, lawyers, travel agents, and exterminators. On the top shelf of the bedroom closet, Coleman found an Apple PowerBook computer. Later that day, Wadi al-Hajj returned. A slender, bearded man with a withered right arm, Hajj had been born in Lebanon, but had gained American citizenship through his wife. He was a convert to Islam from Catholicism, and he had his own ideas about recruitment. He arrived at the meeting with the agents carrying religious tracts and spent the evening trying to get Coleman and the CIA officers to accept Islam. That night in Nairobi, however, one of the CIA men was able to retrieve several deleted documents on the PowerBook's hard drive that substantiated many of the allegations that Jamal al-Fadl had made about the existence of al-Qaeda and its terrorist goals. The criminal case against bin Laden remained unfocused, however. Coleman and the agency men went through the documents, piecing together Hajj's travels. He had bought some guns for bin Laden in Eastern Europe and seemed to be making frequent trips to Tanzania. Al-Qaeda was up to something, but it was unclear what that was. In any case, it was certainly a low-end operation, and the exposure of the safe house in Nairobi had no doubt put an end to it. Chapter 15. Bread and Water. Mullah Omar sent a delegation to Tora Bora to greet bin Laden and learn more about him. Bin Laden's declaration of war and the subsequent international media storm had shocked and divided the Taliban. Some of them pointed out that they had not invited bin Laden to Afghanistan in the first place and were not obliged to protect a man who was endangering their relations with other countries. The Taliban had no quarrel at the time with the United States, which was nominally encouraging their stabilizing influence on the country. Moreover, bin Laden's attacks on the Saudi royal family were a direct violation of a pledge Mullah Omar had made to Prince Turki to keep his guest under control. On the other hand, the Taliban were hopeful that bin Laden could help rebuild Afghanistan's ravaged infrastructure and provide jobs to revivify the dead economy. They flattered him, saying that they considered themselves like the supporters of the Prophet when he took refuge in Medina. They emphasized that so long as he refrained from attacking their sponsor, Saudi Arabia, or speaking to the press, he would be welcome to remain under their protection. In return, bin Laden endorsed their rule unconditionally, although he immediately broke their trust. In March 1997, a television crew for CNN was driven into the frigid mountains above Jalalabad to a blanket-lined mud hut to meet with Osama bin Laden. Since arriving in Afghanistan, the exiled Saudi had already spoken with reporters from the London-based newspapers, The Independent and Al-Quds Al-Arabi. But this was the first television interview he had ever granted. Peter Bergen, the producer, observed that bin Laden seemed to be ill. He walked into the room using a cane and coughed softly throughout the interview. It is possible that, until now, bin Laden had not killed an American or anyone else except on the field of battle. The actions in Aden, Somalia, Riyadh, and Dahran may have been inspired by his words, but it has never been demonstrated that he commanded the terrorists who carried them out. Although Ramzi Youssef had trained in an al-Qaeda camp, bin Laden was not connected to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Bin Laden told the London-based Palestinian editor, Abdelbari Atwan, that al-Qaeda was responsible for the ambush of American forces in Mogadishu in 1993, the National Guard Training Center bombing in Riyadh in 1995, and the Khobar Towers bombing in 1996. But there is no evidence to substantiate these claims. He was certainly surrounded by men like Zawafri, who had plenty of blood on their hands, and he supported their actions in Egypt. He was, as the CIA characterized him at the time, a terrorist financier, albeit a financier without much money. Declaring war on America, however, proved to be a dazzling advertisement for himself and his cause, and irresistible for a man whose fortunes had been so badly trampled upon. Of course, his Taliban hosts forbade such publicity, but once bin Laden had gotten hold of the world's attention, he would allow nothing to pull it out of his grasp. Peter Arnett, the CNN reporter, began by asking bin Laden to state his criticism of the Saudi royal family. Bin Laden said that they were subservient to the United States, and this, based on the ruling of Sharia, cast the regime outside the religious community. In other words, he was declaring takfir against the royal family, saying that they were no longer to be considered Muslims and therefore could be killed. Arnett then asked what kind of society he would create if the Islamic movement were to take over Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden's exact response was this: "We are confident, with the permission of God, praise and glory be to Him, that Muslims will be victorious in the Arabian Peninsula, and that God's religion, praise and glory be to Him, will prevail in this peninsula. It is a great pride and a big hope that the revelation unto Muhammad, peace be upon him, will be resorted to for ruling. When we used to follow Muhammad's revelation, peace be upon him, we were in great happiness and in great dignity. To God belongs the credit and praise." What is notable about this response, filled as usual with ritualistic locutions, is the complete absence of any real political plan beyond imposing Sharia, which, of course, was already in effect in Saudi Arabia. The happiness and dignity that bin Laden invoked lay on the other side of history, from the concepts of nationhood and the state.